Mesdames, Messieurs, donc merci d'être venus ici de manière si nombreuse. Donc, j'ai le grand plaisir aujourd'hui d'accueillir le professeur Jens Schröter, qui vient de l'université Humboldt de Berlin, une grande faculté de théologie où il enseigne le Nouveau Testament. Et M. Schröter, c'est un des plus grands spécialistes de la recherche sur Jésus, sur le Jésus historique. Donc, le livre que je vous présente, que je vais faire circuler, toujours avec l'espoir de le retrouver à la fin. Ce livre, en fait, est la traduction française d'un livre qu'il a écrit il y a presque 10 ans et qui a connu en Allemagne déjà 6 éditions. C'est déjà réédité 6 fois et il a profité en fait de la dernière édition, de la revoir, de l'actualiser. Et la version française donc, que vous avez ici, elle est en effet basée sur la dernière édition allemande. Donc c'est vraiment le dernier état de la question. Hein. Voilà. Alors, M. Schröter s'intéresse aussi un peu au même sujet que je traite cette année mon cours, la naissance de la Bible, plutôt du côté du Nouveau Testament. Et donc, il est en train, en fait, de faire avec un collègue de Zurich, Konrad Schmid, il prépare un livre sur le même thème que j'ai, Die Entstehung der Bibel, la naissance de la Bible, donc en incluant le Nouveau Testament. Ça, c'est un livre, en fait, qui va sortir cette année, je crois. Voilà, donc M. Schröter va parler en anglais. Les diapos, par contre, sont en français, donc c'est un peu comme des sous-titrages, donc ça vous permettra aussi de mieux suivre. Et après, pour les questions, vous pouvez aussi les poser en français, on peut traduire, il n'y a aucun problème. Voilà. Thank you for coming, and the floor is yours.
First of all, thank you very much to my dear colleague and friend Thomas Römer, for inviting me to this very esteemed house here, the Collège de France. It is a great honor and a great pleasure for me to speak to you today. And it is a very great joy for me to be in this house here at this very esteemed place and also in the wonderful city of Paris. I apologize for speaking in English, but perhaps it is easier for you to listen to me when I speak in English than I would do it in French. And I'm very grateful to my dear colleague Valérie Nicolet, who has translated the slides from English into French. So thank you very much for that. The topic, as you can see on the first slide here, is The Quest of a Historical Jesus. In English, the English title is The Quest of a Historical Jesus, Current Issues and Prospects. And my first paragraph is entitled The Quest of a Historical Jesus as a Hermeneutical Challenge. The quest of a historical Jesus is deeply embedded in the intellectual and cultural history of Europe since the 18th century. The historical Jesus, as he is portrayed in current academic books and articles, but also in popular presentations, has therefore to be explained against presuppositions that were established in Enlightenment philosophy and historical critical interpretation of the Bible. Before I turn to characteristics of the current discussion, sometimes labeled as the third quest of the historical Jesus, in the first part of my lecture, I will therefore briefly deal with the roots of the historical Jesus debate and its historical and hermeneutical implications. The view of Jesus as a figure who can and even should be studied in the same way as other individuals of history was developed in European philosophy and theology, especially in England, France, and Germany, since the 18th century. Philosophers, theologians, and artists of previous periods of history, of antiquity, the Middle Ages, and the Reformation era, were also interested in the personality of Jesus. They did, however, not maintain a critical difference between Jesus as a human being and as God's Son, who is of divine origin. By contrast, it was, and still is, a basic conviction of Christian faith that Jesus is of divine and human nature at the same time. A distinction between these two natures of Jesus was established on the basis of philosophy of enlightenment and its critical attitude towards the Christian dogma. For authors like Hermann Samuel Reimarus, Gotthold Ephraim Lessing, Johann Jakob Griesbach and Johann Gottfried Herder, to mention just a few, it was no longer self-evident that the Jesus portrays of the New Testament Gospels could be regarded as trustworthy accounts of Jesus' ministry and passion. Instead, according to their view, the Christ of faith has to be distinguished from Jesus, the human being, who lived and taught in first century Galilee and Judea and was crucified in Jerusalem. The view of Jesus as a human being, in contrast to a divine figure, called into question the Christian doctrine about the two natures of Christ. Instead, as Lessing insisted, Christian faith has to be grounded on a rational basis, and the nasty wide ditch between accidental historical truths and eternal rational truths has to be taken seriously. Humanity, according to Lessing, runs through a process of development that started with the childhood of humanity in the past and develops by continuous unfolding through further revelation. Doctrines such as the unity of God in the Old Testament or the Trinitarian God of Christian faith belong to earlier periods of history, but they are no longer required in more advanced stages of humanity. Moreover, Lessing argues that the religion of Christ has to be distinguished from the Christian religion. According to Lessing, the religion of Christ, that is, the teaching and activity of Jesus, cannot serve as the basis of a Christian religion, because the evangelists, as historians, provide contradictory and incomplete information about the circumstances of Jesus' ministry. On the basis of critical analysis of the New Testament Gospels, the Christian religion can therefore neither be justified nor rejected. Moreover, even if it would be possible to figure out historically reliable data of Jesus' earthly activity, the Gospels could not serve as foundations of the truth of Christian faith, and also these historical data could not serve as a foundation of Christian truth because, as Lessing puts it, quote, incidental historical truths can never become the proof of essential rational truths, end quote. Instead, the truth of Christianity and of Christian faith must be derived from what Lessing called the proof of spirit and power. In a similar way, like Lessing, also Hermann Samuel Reimarus differentiated between the teaching of Jesus and that of the apostles. In two fragments of his work, the work is called Apology or Defense for the Rational Worshippers of God, and the two fragments are entitled The Resurrection Narratives and The Goal of Jesus and His Disciples. In these two fragments that were posthumously edited by Lessing, Reimarus argues that Jesus' teaching would have to be interpreted in the context of Judaism of Jesus' own time. Jesus, according to Reimarus, addressed his fellow Jews with an ethical message about the life of according to God's will, and to convince them, so Jesus wanted to convince them to change their lives and take Jesus' interpretation of God's commandments seriously. The doctrine of the resurrection and exaltation, the interpretation of Jesus' death as the dying for the sins of humankind, and other parts of the Christian dogma, by contrast, according to Reimarus, were only invented after Jesus' death by his apostles, who wanted to continue with Jesus' proclamation of God's dawning kingdom. Lessing and Reimarus, in their own ways, therefore separated the message and religion of Jesus from the proclamation about him as the basis of Christian faith. A second characteristic of this new approach was that the differences between the Gospels were taken as evidence that not all of them, perhaps even none of them, would provide a historically accurate portrait of Jesus' activity. This view was first formulated by Johann Jakob Griesbach at the end of the 18th century. According to Griesbach, it is doubtful, quote, whether a harmonious narrative can be composed from the books of the evangelists, which in terms of a chronological order of a pericopes sufficiently coincides with reality and which is built on secure foundation. Griesbach continues that it is entirely conceivable that none of the evangelists exactly followed the chronological sequence of Jesus' activity, and that it would not be possible to determine which evangelist was deviating from the chronological order at which point. And Griesbach sums up, quote, "And I confess that I am of this heretical view," end quote. The quest of a historical Jesus was originated at a time when critical reason was established as the benchmark of the interpretation of biblical texts. This development can be perceived as a consequence of a confessionalization of Western Christianity and the sensitivity for other religions such as Judaism and Islam with their own truth claims. As a consequence, the idea of a divinely inspired text of the Bible was replaced by the search for a rational religion and the search for a universal truth that should be able to overcome the disparities between the Christian denominations and perhaps even between the different religions. In this context, the humanity of Jesus became the focus of interest, whereas his divinity was increasingly regarded as problematic. The gospel writers were perceived as Lessing puts it, merely human historians. Those accounts have to be interpreted with the help of historical critical analysis. On this basis, the Jesus books of the so-called liberal Life of Jesus research of the 19th century aimed at depictions of Jesus which would make his activity and fate comprehensible on a historical critical basis. Jesus' miracles were explained with the help of rational analysis. His healings were regarded as medical therapies in which Jesus would have used the knowledge of contemporary medicine and so forth. This rational, critical view of Jesus and the Gospels raised the question of the most reliable sources about Jesus. Already in the 18th century, presumptions about Gospels that were not preserved in the New Testament were formulated. In his essay, New Hypothesis about the Evangelists as Merely Human Historians from 1778, Lessing speculated about a Gospel of the Nazarenes or Gospel of the Hebrews, which would have been used by the authors of the New Testament Gospels independently of each other and could therefore explain the differences between them. With this view, Lessing wanted to explain why the evangelists, even when referring to the same events, often differ in sequence and narrative details of their accounts. In subsequent periods, the question of the sources for a historical portrait of Jesus was often answered on the basis of a so-called two-source hypothesis, which assumes that the Gospel of Mark was the oldest of the New Testament Gospels, and a second source, mainly the sayings and speeches of Jesus, which would not have been preserved by itself, but could be reconstructed to a certain degree from the Gospels of Matthew and Luke. At the end of the 19th century, the quest of the sources for a reconstruction of a historical Jesus was again broadened. The discovery of fragments of non-canonical Gospels, such as the Gospel of Peter, or papyri with sayings or episodes about Jesus, stimulated discussions about the contribution of these non-canonical texts to a reconstruction of the historical Jesus. Today, it is widely acknowledged that the quest of the historical Jesus cannot be restricted to the New Testament Gospels or even to the Synoptic Gospels, so that is, the first three Gospels of Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Instead, the New Testament Gospels have to be integrated into a wider spectrum of early Christian texts about Jesus and used together with other remains, Jewish writings, archaeological and numismatic testimonies, as well as other early Christian texts as sources for the historical Jesus. An obvious problem raised by the historical critical Jesus research is the incompatibility of the historical Jesus and the Christ of faith. If Jesus was a first century Jew who addressed his fellow Jews with a call to conversion because of God's dawning kingdom, who healed the sick and disputed with the Pharisees and scribes and was eventually crucified by the Romans, how could he become the Messiah of Israel and the Son of God, who was believed as being resurrected by God from the dead and venerated as the exalted Lord sitting at the right hand of God? In other words, how can the relationship between the earthly Jesus and the race of Christian faith be described? This problem has intrigued theologians and Jesus scholars since the rise of critical theology. Is Christian faith rooted in the activity of the earthly Jesus, or did Christian faith only start with the earliest confessions after Jesus' resurrection and exaltation? In other words, is there a continuity between Jesus and Christianity, or is Jesus' activity just the presupposition of Christian faith, but not a part of it, as Rudolf Bultmann has put it in a well-known statement at the beginning of his Theology of the New Testament? Scholars have answered this question in different ways. In the 19th century, David Friedrich Strauss argued that the historical contours of the Jesus figure would vanish in the midst of the interpretations of the gospel writers who used mythological ideas, mainly from the Old Testament, to interpret Jesus' activity on earth. According to Strauss, the authors of the Gospels presupposed the Christian dogma about Jesus as a human figure of divine origin and shaped their Jesus stories accordingly. The truth of the Christian dogma, Strauss argued, is not affected by this character of the Gospels. However, this Christian dogma cannot be based on historical ground, since the historical events are inextricably interwoven with pious reflections or fantasies, as Strauss calls that, of the first Christians presented in the Gospels as historical elements of Jesus' life. Strauss' view was continued in a certain sense by Martin Kähler and Rudolf Bultmann. They argued that a historical Jesus cannot be reconstructed behind the theological interpretation of the Gospels. The earliest Christian authors were interested in the person of Jesus only from a perspective of Christian faith, not in a historical Jesus in a modern critical sense. To search for a historical Jesus independent of Christian faith would therefore be on a wrong track. In a formulation which recalls the view of Strauss, Bultmann writes that in the kerygma, the historical person of Jesus was replaced by the mythical figure of the Son of God. Wherefore, the object of faith is not the historical Jesus, but the Christ of the kerygma. This view of Strauss and Kähler and Bultmann has caused much criticism. Ernst Käsemann, in the middle of the 20th century, argued that despite the interpretation of Jesus' activity and his passion from a perspective of Christian faith, it would be possible and even necessary to reconstruct the historical traces of the pre-Easter period. Otherwise, Christian faith would lose its historical basis. From a different perspective, it was maintained that a reconstruction of the historical Jesus is possible, because there are sufficient sources for a historical portrait of Jesus, and it would be necessary to excavate the historical truth behind the Christian dogma. This latter view was emphasized in the beginnings of the so-called third quest of the historical Jesus by John Dominic Crossan, for example, Marcus Borg, and others, especially in the United States. In the footsteps of Reimarus, these scholars underlined the difference between the historical Jesus on the one hand and Christian faith on the other. Other representatives of a new phase of Jesus research, the so-called third quest of the historical Jesus, as for example James Dunn, instead argued that there would be a continuity between Jesus and the origin of Christian faith. James Dunn pointed to the impact of Jesus that would have left its traces in the earliest Jesus tradition and could therefore lead back to the contents of Jesus' activity itself. As these remarks demonstrate, historical Jesus research since its beginnings in the 18th century struggles with the following questions. First, How can Jesus be portrayed as a human being? Are there reliable sources to depict his earthly activity on the basis of historical critical interpretation? Is it possible to discover the historical events behind these sources, or do Jesus scholars only find what they are looking for? That is, are their reconstructions actually constructions of the past from their own viewpoints? And second, how can the earthly Jesus be related to the origin of Christian faith? Is there a continuity leading from Jesus to the earliest Christian confessions? And finally, what are the consequences of historical Jesus research for Christian faith in current periods? Is there a particular responsibility of Christian theology and especially of New Testament scholars for a plausible and reliable portrayal of a historical Jesus, or could theology refrain from it and go without a historical Jesus? With these questions, in the next part of my lecture, I will turn to some characteristics of current Jesus research. So, second, the so-called third quest of the historical Jesus. In the 70s and 80s of the 20th century, a new period of Jesus research was inaugurated mainly by North American scholars. This fresh perspective, which called itself third quest of the historical Jesus, quickly became popular also in European scholarship. Its main characteristic is the consideration of a broad range of historical material by including not only the synoptic gospels, but also archaeological and epigraphical data from the Galilee and Judea, Jewish writings from the Second Temple period, and non-canonical texts of early Christianity, as for example the so-called apocryphal gospels. So here you have some examples. On the left, on the left-hand side of this slide is a Jewish text from Nachal Chefa, so that is close to the Dead Sea. It's a Greek text of a minor prophet in the Old Testament in Greek. So the so-called Nachal Chefa minor prophet scroll. And on the right-hand side, you have an inscription on a stone which names the prefect Pontius Pilatus. So in the second line here, you can see Pilatus. And this is a nailed leg. So the bones of a leg with a nail through it. So it was found in a cemetery in Jerusalem and is now in the Israel Museum in Jerusalem. So these are just some examples for archaeological findings and texts that were brought into the discussion about the historical Jesus in the so-called third quest since the 70s or 80s of the 20th century. That means that the historical context of Jesus' activity has been considered much more closely now than in previous periods of Jesus research. Jesus is now interpreted within Judaism of his own time, but also the influence of Greek and Roman culture on the Galilee and Judea is considered, as is the political and social context of the Roman Empire. Of specific importance are the regions of Jesus' activity, namely Galilee and Judea. Besides John Dominic Crossan's monograph, which was already mentioned, important publications from this phase of Jesus research are the Jesus books from James Dunn, Sean Frain, and Dale Ellison, among others. Although these publications are different in their approach and results, they share the common characteristics of the so-called third quest. As a consequence of this approach, the historical value of the New Testament Gospels was reconsidered. Especially the Synoptic Gospels, but to a certain degree also the Gospel of John, provide information about the places of Jesus' activity, about his followers and opponents, and about circumstances of his healings, his proclamation of the kingdom of God, and the encounters with people in the Galilean villages, as well as in the surrounding regions, as the Decapolis in the east and the Syro-Phoenician coastal region and Jerusalem. The Jesus books of this period can therefore be characterized as detailed descriptions of the historical context of first century Galilee and Judea, sometimes even of a Mediterranean world altogether. Moreover, characteristics of Jesus' activity, for example, his attitude towards the law, as it can be perceived from the Sabbath controversies, the debates about purity and the validity of the Jewish law in general, were included in the portrayals of Jesus, with special regard to Jewish writings of that period, as for example, the Qumran texts and other Jewish writings of that period, so that is the Hellenistic Roman time. In the beginnings of this newly initiated interest in the activity of Jesus, it was expected that a comprehensive and careful analysis of the available material would lead to a historical, plausible, consistent historical portrait of Jesus. However, the hermeneutical challenge of interpreting the Gospels as historical and theological accounts of Jesus outlined in, as it was outlined in the previous paragraph, this hermeneutical challenge was not sufficiently considered in the early stages of the so-called third quest of the historical Jesus. Instead, it was taken for granted that on the basis of available evidence, a historical portrait of Jesus can be generated. The epistemological presuppositions of historical critical research, by contrast, received attention only at a later stage of the discussion. It has to be noted, however, that interpretation of historical data is always determined by the available evidence and by the viewpoint of the interpreter. With regard to the former, so that is the available evidence and its interpretation, the perception of Second Temple Judaism has changed considerably since the discovery of the Qumran scrolls and the edition and translation of many Jewish writings from that time. The knowledge of Christianity of the first three centuries of the Common Era likewise became much broader and more nuanced since the discovery and publication of many so-called apocryphal writings since the late 19th century. Against this background, in the last decades, it has become common to speak of Judaisms or Christianities in the plural, to point out that neither Judaism nor Christianity of the Hellenistic Roman period were uniform religious communities. Instead, there were various strands of Judaism and Christianity that interacted with each other in different ways. With regard to the epistemological presupposition of critical historiography, it should be noted that any interpretation of historical data is dependent not only on the remains of the past preserved in the present, but also on the cultural and social situation of the interpreter. Jesus scholars of the 19th century could not consider the Dead Sea Scrolls and many other Jewish and Christian writings because in that time they were simply not known. However, scholars of that period also had other presuppositions for the interpretation of historical sources. In the 19th and early 20th century, Jesus was often portrayed as a great character and in contrast to Judaism of his time. Today, there is much more sensitivity for the Jewish context of Jesus and his followers, and also for the diversity of Judaism of the Roman Empire. A historical portrait of Jesus, like any other historical reconstruction, is thus always a mixture of reconstruction and construction. Historical data are open to a variety of interpretations, although not to any interpretation. The historical sources limit the possibilities of interpretation, but they do not lead to one uniform portrait of Jesus. Thus, it comes as no surprise that the Jesus books of the so-called third quest provide different images of Jesus instead of one uniform portrait. There are portrayals of Jesus as a Mediterranean Jewish peasant, as a Jewish crucified Messiah, as an eschatological millenarian prophet, and so forth. Not all of these portraits are of the same plausibility and persuasiveness. It should be kept in mind, however, that the task of historical Jesus research is not to convey a unified portrait of Jesus behind the available evidence. Instead, the historical critical Jesus can also be called the remembered Jesus, applying the social memory approach to the historical Jesus research. That means that portraits of a historical Jesus serve as bridges between our modern critical perception and the world of antiquity. These portraits provide plausible, but by the same time provisional and revisable portrayals of Jesus. As such, they are a necessary fundamental part of Christian theology, since it has to be explained historically why and how Jesus' activity and fate caused a movement that eventually resulted in a new religion within the Roman Empire and beyond. Against this background, in the next paragraph, I will concentrate on some aspects of a portrait of a historical figure of Jesus in light of current research. So my third paragraph is entitled The Galilee of Jesus. In current Jesus research, Galilee as the historical context of Jesus was investigated from historical as well as from archaeological perspectives, whereby several important insights were formulated. Concerning the history of the Galilee as a consequence of the Assyrian conquest in the 8th century BCE, the population in the Galilee was considerably diminished. Unlike in Samaria, the Assyrians did not bring a foreign upper class to the Galilee. Consequently, in the Galilee, there was no mixed population in the Persian and Hellenistic Roman period. Another important result of the archaeological excavation was that in Persian and early Hellenistic times, there were only a few settlements in the Galilee. In the late 2nd as well as in the 1st century BCE, the number of Jewish settlements increased considerably. This can be explained as a consequence of a Maccabean conquest of the Jewish territory and the surrounding regions in the 2nd and 1st century. Galilee, now in the 1st century before the Common Era, was conquered by the Hasmoneans in the late 2nd and in the 1st century BCE and populated by Jews who probably came from Judea in the 1st century CE. BCE and 1st century CE. As a consequence of this development, so here you can see the conquest of the Maccabeans, so who conquered first Judea and then this blue area and then the other ones, and in the late 2nd century BCE also the Galilee of Jesus. So it became a Jewish region since the late 2nd century BCE, and then it was populated by Jews in the 1st century BCE and also in the 1st century CE. So that is an important historical background for the activity of Jesus in the first decades of the 1st century CE. So as a consequence of these developments, the Galilee of Jesus was a Jewish region with almost no traces of pagan, that means Greek or Roman, remains. This did not change after the Romans conquered the region in 64-63 BCE, and it remained also the same in the time of Herod the Great, who ruled over a large territory to the east, the north, and the west of the Jordan Valley. So this is the territory of Herod the Great's reign. And Herod the Great ruled from 37 to 4 BCE, with this Jewish central region of Galilee, Judea, and also Perea, which is here to the east of the Jordan and the Dead Sea. And it preserved, this whole region preserved its Jewish character, and especially Judea in the south, Galilee in the north, and Perea here to the east of the Jordan and the Dead Sea remained Jewish territory. Then after Herod's death, his territory was divided among his three sons. So this territory was ruled now by one son of Herod the Great, his son Philip, and this one, Galilee and Perea, by a second son who is called Antipas. And the third one is this green one here. This was ruled by a third son of Herod the Great with the name of Archelaus. So after Jesus' death, this territory of Herod the Great was divided among three of his sons. And Galilee, together with a geographically disconnected Perea, which is here, came under the rule of Antipas, who in the Gospels is always called just Herod. Antipas reconstructed the city of Sepphoris, which you can see here. And Sepphoris was destroyed by the Roman governor of Syria, Publius Quintilius Varus, in 4 BCE. And Herod Antipas, so who ruled now over the Galilee, made Sippori, or Sepphoris, his residence for the first approximately 20 years of his reign. Sepphoris was a Jewish city with some influence of Roman architecture. It was constructed according to the Roman street system with a cardo, so that is a street that goes from the north to the south, and a decumanus that goes from the east to the west. This is a typical Roman street system. And Sippori or Sepphoris also had a lower and a upper forum. So here in the foreground you can see the lower forum, and in the background you can see the upper forum here on a hill. And Sippori or Sepphoris also had a small theater, so it had some characteristics of an ancient city. Near, so that is a small, and you can see the lower stairs are reconstructed, and it's not very well preserved, as you can see here in the upper part of a small, it's only a small theater here in Sepphoris. Near the upper forum, which we just saw, was a Jewish residential area with several houses that had their own ritual baths, mikvaot, as you can see here. So these stepped pools which lead into a ritual bath. So this is one of the safest evidence for a Jewish residential area. And it is quite remarkable that it was very close to the upper forum of Sepphoris. So the Jewish, this is one evidence for the Jewish character of Sepphoris. And here you can see a part of a cardo of Sepphoris with some traces of a Roman wagons in it. So you can see the Roman character on the right hand side and the Jewish character of Sepphoris on the left hand side of this slide. And the Jewish character of Sepphoris is also attested by two inscriptions from the 2nd and 1st century BCE. One inscription is on a clay jug, the other one on a weight. And you can see it is written in Hebrew, and the Greek translation would be epimeletes, that means probably procurator, or in Greek strategos. And the other inscription has a Jewish name, so it's Simon and Justus. It's the son, it's, Simon, the son of Justus, and Simon or Simono in Greek is a clear Jewish name, and that is very remarkable because he is a market supervisor, and so that means he had an administrative function here in the city of Sepphoris, and he was obviously a Jew because Simon is a very clear Jewish name. So. So we have some evidence for the Jewish character of Sepphoris, one of the cities in the Galilee, and on the other hand, there are no remains of non-Jewish residences or pagan temples in the city of Sepphoris. That is quite remarkable. In 19 CE, so approximately 20 years after Sepphoris was reconstructed, Antipas built a new city at the western shore of the Sea of Galilee. It was named Tiberias after the Roman Emperor Tiberius, and it is even called today Tiberias. And this city consisted of an entrance through a massive city gate from the south, so you can see one of the towers of a city gate on this slide, which is quite remarkable because they didn't have any function. It was just for representative It was just for representative reasons, so just for representation. So Antipas built a massive city gate here to through which one could enter the city from the south. And Tiberias also had a street system with a cardo, as you can see here on this slide. This is a cardo of Tiberias, and leading to a forum. So the forum, so that this is also the Roman city system with a cardo leading to a forum. And on the lower side here of this slide, you can see the theater of Tiberias, which is of the same size as what we saw earlier in Sipori. So in Sepphoris, there's a similar theater like here. So also this, the other city has similar characteristics, and it was built by Antipas around the year 90. On the occasion of the founding of Tiberias, Antipas coined the first of five coin series of his reign. Remarkably, all of Antipas' coins bear floral motifs like date palms or reed, as you can see here on these images, whereas Antipas did not use images of the emperor, Tiberius, or pagan deities or temples, so they never appear on Antipas' coins. This is probably due to Antipas' respect for the Jewish character of his territory. Also in Tiberias, two lead whites were found with the names of supervisors of the city market, as you can see here. The first one on the upper side of this slide, the first one mentions the tetrarch Herod. So here is the name Herod, and here in Greek, which was the official, so the tetrarch. So Tetrarch was that was the official title of Antipas, and it also mentions the Latin name Gaius Julius, which probably refers to Agrippa I, who was Antipas' brother-in-law, who later became the king of the Jews. Agrippa, who is probably mentioned here, was educated in Rome and later became a market supervisor in Tiberias. The lower inscription mentions the Jewish names Isaiah, son of Matthias, and Animos, son of Monimos, which you can also see here on the right-hand side, as market supervisors. These two inscriptions therefore point to the administration of Tiberias by members of the Herodian family as well as by Jewish representatives. Further evidence for the Jewish character of the Galilee is provided by the synagogues. There has been much discussion about synagogues in Palestine before the destruction of Jerusalem and the Temple in the year 70. It has been questioned that there were synagogues at all in the time when the Jerusalem Temple was the central Jewish place of worship, so that means in the time before 70. There is, however, enough evidence for synagogues, even in Jerusalem itself, but also in the Galilee before the destruction of Jerusalem and the Temple. The famous Theodotos inscription, which you can see here, which was discovered in a cistern in Jerusalem in 1913, this famous inscription mentions a certain Theodotos, a priest and archi-synagogos, so head of a synagogue, and he was himself son of an archi-synagogos, a grandson of an archi-synagogos, and he, this Theodotos, built the synagogue for the reading of the Torah and for teaching the commandments, as well as a hostel and a water installation for lodging of strangers. The inscription, the Theodotos inscription, can probably be dated to the 30s or 40s of the first century of the Common Era, certainly in the time before 70. Synagogues in Jerusalem as gathering places of Jews from different regions of the Mediterranean are also mentioned in the Acts of the Apostles in the New Testament in chapter 6, where Luke, the author of Acts, refers to synagogues of the so-called Libertines, or freedmen, the Cyrenians, the Alexandrians, and both the Jews from Cilicia and Asia. So there are several synagogues mentioned in that sentence in the Acts of the Apostles, several synagogues within, several synagogues in Jerusalem. On the eastern shore of the Sea of Galilee, so if you now go to the Galilee, on the eastern shore of the Sea of Galilee, a synagogue from a period before 70 was discovered in Gamla, and that synagogue was discovered already in 1976. Here is an image of a synagogue. So here on that image, you can see the city of Gamla, and the synagogue is over here. And here you can see an image of the synagogue. And in 2009, so just 10 years ago, a synagogue from the same period, so that means before 70, was found in Magdala at the western shore of the Sea of Galilee. Here is a famous stone that was found in this synagogue of Magdala, and this is a mosaic mosaic on the floor of this synagogue of Magdala, which also comes from the time before 70. Other synagogues, such here in Capernaum, or this one in El Kanatir, this is in the Golan Heights, these synagogues are either only attested by the literary evidence, as for example a synagogue in Tiberias, or they are from later centuries, as these two. So the synagogue of Capernaum and this here in El Kanatir are of later centuries. But we have some evidence in Gamla and in Magdala also for synagogues from the first century, so that means from the time when the temple was still there in Jerusalem. Finally, it should be mentioned that the Galilee was and still is a mainly rural religion with only a few small cities. In antiquity, Sepphoris and Tiberias were the only places which were called cities, so polis in Greek, by Flavius Josephus. However, recent excavations in Magdala have shown that Magdala was very important for the economical and social character of the Galilee. So here's a commercial street in Galilee showing that there was also a commercial area in Magdala. And this is a big residential villa here in Magdala, which shows that there was also some wealthy population in Magdala. And this one is especially interesting because it is a big house, a villa with a mikveh. And that we have a house with a mikveh here in Magdala, in Magdala is especially interesting because it is so close to the sea. And that means that only rich people have a ritual bath in their own house. So, and that is especially striking here in that area where obviously the richer people of Magdala lived. So Magdala is a very interesting place, and it was excavated in the last 10 to 15 years. Magdala was founded in Maccabean times, so in the 2nd century BCE, and served as a trade center in the Galilean region, as the huge harbor indicates that what was excavated in more recent times. So Magdala had a very huge harbor that is very interesting at the Sea of Galilee. Moreover, a public bathhouse was excavated, and Josephus mentions a hippodrome in Magdala. That means that Magdala had an urban character as well, so besides Sepphoris and Tiberias, and obviously served as one of the main places in the Galilee in Maccabean times. Despite this character, Antipas, so the ruler about the Galilee in Jesus' time, did not use Magdala as a place for his residence, but instead built an entirely new city very close to Magdala. So that's very interesting. The harbor was a trading center, connected the region with the Decapolis in the east. So it was a harbor on the west side of the Sea of Galilee, and it connected the region, obviously, with the east. So with the Decapolis, which was to the east of the Sea of Galilee. The harbor of Magdala is a trading center, therefore is also an indication for trade relations of the Galilee with the surrounding regions, and these trade relations are also attested by the trade routes, so by several streets running through the Galilee from the south to the north. So you can see some of these streets here. The red ones are big streets, and the yellow ones are smaller streets, and you have a very dense street system in the Galilee, running through from the north to the south and also from the east to the west. Besides these three major places, So Sepphoris and Tiberias and Magdala, there were many smaller settlements and villages in the Galilee. In the time of Antipas, the region flourished, as is indicated by the economic relationships and also by the fact that there were no social or economic uprisings at Antipas and Jesus' time. Instead, the political and social situation was comparatively calm, although it is likely that social tensions existed, for example, between landowners and the poor people. Because of this character of the Galilee in the time of Jesus, it comes as no surprise that there are only very few traces of a direct confrontation of Antipas and John the Baptist or Jesus. The Gospels report the beheading of John the Baptist by Antipas, this is in Mark 6, and the parallel stories in Matthew and Luke, as well as a warning of the Pharisees who make Jesus aware that Antipas wants to kill him, so this is in Luke 13. Besides these two episodes, there are no direct encounters between Antipas and John the Baptist or Jesus and his followers. The third part of my lecture, and this last part before a short conclusion, is devoted to Jesus, a Jew from Galilee. So the title of his paragraph is Jesus, a Jew from Galilee. The Synoptic Gospels mention several Galilean villages, as you can see here, as places of Jesus' activity, such as Capernaum, Nazareth, nine is not here on the map, and Cana, which is over here, as well as Bethsaida, and the villages of Caesarea Philippi, which is here in the north, in the territory of Antipas' brother Philip. The Galilean cities, Sepphoris and Tiberias, so Sepphoris is here and Tiberias is here, however, as well as Magdala, or Migdal, which is here, these places, which as we saw had an urban character, are no places of Jesus' public ministry. Instead, his activity was, so here we have places in the surrounding of the Galilee, and Jesus' activity was concentrated on the Galilean villages, with Capernaum as a center according to the Synoptic accounts. So according to the Synoptic Gospels, Capernaum was the center of Jesus' activity. In John's Gospel, this is a bit different. The references to marketplaces in Greek agorai, as well as the rural imagery of the parables, of Jesus' parables, in which landowners, day laborers, sowers, seeds, and plants are used as symbols for the kingdom of God. So these parables reflect the character of a Galilean landscape. The Gospels also describe Jesus traveling freely between the Galilee and the adjacent regions to the east and the west, so the Decapolis in the east and the Syrophoenician coastal region in the west, which reflects the situation in the time of Antipas and Jesus, but this free movement of Jesus would hardly fit to the political circumstances after the Jewish-Roman War of the years 66 to 74. Although the New Testament Gospels are written at a later time and with a different political framework, they depict Jesus' activity in a way that also considers the situation of the Galilee in the time and Antipas of Jesus some decades earlier. An obvious feature of Jesus' activity was the founding of a community of followers. In the Gospel of Mark, this is the very first episode of Jesus' public appearance. In Mark 1, Mark chapter 1, verse 16 to 20, we read as following. As Jesus passed along the Sea of Galilee, and you can see the French translation here, as Jesus passed along the Sea of Galilee, he saw Simon and his brother, so this is Simon Peter, and his brother Andrew casting a net into the sea, for they were fishermen. And Jesus said to them, "Follow me, and I will make you fish for people." And immediately they left their nets and followed him. As he went a little farther, he saw James, son of Zebedee, and his brother John, who were in their boat mending the nets. Immediately he called them, and they left their father Zebedee in the boat with the hired men and followed him. So this is Mark chapter 1, verse 16 to 20. This episode of the calling of two pairs of brothers is a programmatic scene composed by the author of Mark's Gospel against the background of the calling of Elisha, narrated in the first book of Kings in chapter 19. Nevertheless, the episode shows some characteristics of Jesus' activity. The most important ones are the following. Jesus asks fishermen at the Sea of Galilee to join him in the proclamation of the kingdom of God. Fishermen did not belong to the poor of the Galilean population as it was assumed in previous research. Instead, fishing was a business which required specific skills and equipment. To run a fishing business was therefore only possible for people who were able to afford the necessary utensils and were able to hire day laborers. Moreover, fishing was an attractive business in the Galilee, since fish from the sea was one of the main export products in the Galilean trade, besides olive oil and ceramics. The Gospels depict several controversies between Jesus and his Jewish opponents, especially the Pharisees and the scribes, about the interpretation of the Jewish law. These stories can be read against the background of a Galilean milieu in that Jewish groups, especially the Pharisees, were keen to establish the Jewish law as the benchmark of daily life for the Galilean population. By the same time, these conflict stories serve as portrayals of Jesus who interprets the Jewish law in his own authority. As an example, I refer to the controversy about Sabbath observance in Luke 14, verse 1 to 6. On one occasion, when Jesus was going to the house of a leader of the Pharisees to eat a meal on this Sabbath, they were watching him closely. Just when, in front of him, there was a man who had dropsy. And Jesus asked the lawyers and Pharisees, is it lawful to cure people on the Sabbath or not? But they were silent. So Jesus took him and healed him and sent him away. Then he said to them, if one of you has a child or an ox that has fallen into a well, will you not immediately pull it out on a Sabbath day? And they could not reply to this. This story is the last Sabbath controversy in Luke's Gospel. It can therefore be regarded as a climax of the conflicts about Jesus' Sabbath healings in the Gospel of Luke. A remarkable characteristic of the story is that Jesus himself takes the initiative of asking the lawyers and Pharisees about the Sabbath regulations. The first question is about healing on a Sabbath in a very general way. It shifts the debate on another level. The issue is not specific Sabbath regulations, but the fundamental question of healing on a Sabbath at all. In Mark 3, verse 4, this is formulated even sharper. So this is a parallel in Mark chapter 3. It reads, is it lawful to do good or to do harm on the Sabbath, to save life or to kill? So this is a Mark inversion of that question. With these questions, Jesus essentially calls into question the way the Sabbath is interpreted by his Jewish opponents. The Sabbath was made by God for the sake of humankind, therefore healing on the Sabbath corresponds to the order of creation. Jesus' rhetorical question therefore overrules the Jewish debates about Sabbath observance with a general theological argument. By the same time, it puts Jesus in the position of bringing God's salvation to humankind on the Sabbath. Because this rhetorical question transcends Jewish categories of Sabbath observance, his opponents cannot answer it and they remain silent. But the story does not end here. After Jesus has healed the man with a dropsy, he asks a second rhetorical question about pulling a child or an ox out of a well. Similar questions occur in Luke 13, verse 15, and in Matthew 12, verse 11, related to animals that need water or have fallen into a pit on the Sabbath. This question, this second rhetorical question, functions on a different level than the first one. It argues with a minore ad maius conclusion, so from the lower to the more important. A human being is much more valuable than an animal. Therefore, Jesus' healing is justified by the Sabbath practice of his opponents itself. Whether this argument is valid with regard to actual Jewish Sabbath regulations remains questionable because there were different views on the issue raised by Jesus. However, the rhetorical clue of the story is to demonstrate that with his arguments, Jesus silenced his opponents. Jesus' authoritative interpretation of the Jewish law, which can be perceived also from other episodes, is accompanied by his claim to act as God's representative and in God's authority. By way of example, I refer to an episode from the Gospel of Mark. In Mark 2, verse 1 to 12, Mark reports Jesus' healing of a paralyzed man. As with Sabbath controversies, also this story consists of a second level, which points to the specific meaning of Jesus' healings. Jesus unexpectedly does not heal the disability of a lame man, but instead he says to him, "Child, your sins are forgiven." This causes irritation on the part of the scribes who observe Jesus. They regard the saying of Jesus as blasphemy because no one but God alone can forgive sins. Jesus, who perceives it in his mind that they are considering these things in their hearts, reacts with another remarkable saying: "The Son of Man has authority on earth to forgive sins." Only after this saying, as a proof of his authority, he heals the paralyzed. The self-designation as the Son of Man points to Jesus' self-perception as God's representative on earth. There are good reasons to assume that Jesus himself used this expression to describe his own role in the process of God's dawning kingdom. Apparently, Jesus used this expression to speak of himself as a human being who, as God's representative, is commissioned to bring about God's kingdom. After Easter, the expression Son of Man was expanded to describe not only Jesus' earthly ministry, but also his suffering, his death and resurrection, as well as his return at the end of time. Moreover, the designation Son of Man was now, after Easter, combined with other Christological titles, such as Christ or Son of God. In the episode of a paralyzed man here in Mark 2, Jesus refers to his authority on earth, which corresponds to God's authority in heaven. The scribes do not recognize Jesus' exclusive relationship to God and his actions in God's authority, but instead perceive him as an ordinary Jew from a Galilean village. As these examples demonstrate, the Jesus portrays of the Synoptic Gospels, and in its own way also the Gospel of John, take up certain aspects which probably go back to the earthly Jesus as a Galilean Jew. These aspects describe his activity in the geographic, social, and political circumstances of first century Galilee and also of Judea and Jerusalem. They pick up features of his activity, such as the founding of a circle of followers, his healings, his teaching in parables, his controversies with the Pharisees about the interpretation of the law, and Jesus' self-interpretation as God's final envoy. The gospel writers interpret these characteristics on the basis of Easter faith and from the perspective of their own later time, that is, from the end of the first century. The Gospels can therefore be called transparent Jesus stories, which make the activity and fate of Jesus accessible and meaningful for the situation of Christian communities in the last decades of the first century of the Common Era. This can be perceived from the presentation of Jesus as Son of God, who has been bestowed with God's Spirit and therefore acts in divine authority. Some stories particularly point to this divine dimension of Jesus' activity. In Mark 6 and Matthew 14, Jesus, walking on the Sea of Galilee, reveals himself in the form of a theophany, similar to God's self-revelation in the Old Testament as "I am He," sometimes supplemented with "Be not afraid." Jesus' divine character is also emphasized in the story of the stilling of a storm and in his transfiguration, where he is declared as God's beloved Son in the presence of three of his disciples. Moreover, the gospel writers have included early confession formula in their narratives, such as "He has been raised, he is not here" in Mark 16, verse 6, Or the Lord has risen indeed and he has appeared to Simon in Luke 24, verse 34. With these confessions, the gospel writers connect Jesus' earthly activity to his resurrection and his Easter appearances. This tendency to place the Jesus story in the frame of Easter faith is further elaborated in the birth stories in the Gospels of Matthew and Luke, which present Jesus as God's son and Israel's Davidic Messiah, as well as by the appearances of the risen Jesus in the Gospels of Matthew, Luke, and John. These appearance stories connect Jesus' earthly activity with the proclamation of the message of Christ after Easter. The Gospels can therefore be described as stories that in particular ways connect the earthly ministry of Jesus with the confession that he is God's representative who brought about the kingdom of God on earth. This relationship is the particular challenge for contemporary historical Jesus research. So, finally, a short conclusion. The historical Jesus and the Christ of faith. As was outlined at the beginning of this lecture today, historical Jesus research in the time of Enlightenment and historical criticism faces the hermeneutical challenge of the relationship between the Jesus of history and the Christ of faith. For a proper pursuit of the quest, both aspects have to be taken seriously. Concerning the former, so that means the Jesus of history, the intense study of Judaism in the Hellenistic Roman period in general, and the detailed description of Galilee as the context of Jesus' activity in particular, have resulted in a much clearer picture of Jesus in Judaism of his time, but also of the Jewish traditions that were used to interpret Jesus' proclamation of the dawning kingdom of God and his self-perception. For Jesus, the apocalyptic idea of God's reign that will be brought about by God himself plays an important role, combined with the idea that he, Jesus himself, is appointed to play a decisive role in this scenario. The Galilee was regarded by Jesus as part of a promised land, and he perceived his own activity as a mission to God's people, Israel. The geographical and social situation provided the concrete context in that Jesus' healings and his communal meals took place as the unpretentious commencement of God's reign. Jesus took up traditions from Jewish scripture to proclaim that God's reign was addressed primarily to the poor, the sick, and the needy. Jesus used the self-designation Son of Man to express his self-perception as God's representative on earth. His followers applied designations such as Christ, Messiah, or Son of God, Son of David, also Lord and Prophet, to Jesus, which had their own meanings in Jewish tradition. With their usage for the interpretation of Jesus' activity and fate, these expressions got a new meaning as designations of God's final envoy, who was crucified and risen. Christian theology also interpreted Jesus' death as an atonement for the sins of the human beings, or even the creation of the world as God's action through Jesus Christ. It is evident that these and other views go far beyond what can be said about the historical Jesus. However, historical Jesus research provides a basis not for Christian faith as such, but for its historical origin as well as for essential aspects of its shape and its ethos. From a hermeneutical and epistemological perspective, the historical Jesus and the Christ of faith should therefore not be played off against each other, neither should they be regarded as two separate, unrelated perspectives on Jesus. Instead, the quest of the historical Jesus should be regarded as a hermeneutical enterprise which is of substantial importance for Christian theology and faith. Historical Jesus research does not provide a unified, unambiguous portrait of Jesus behind the earliest texts. However, it provides historical critical portrayals of Jesus which serve as an orientation of Christianity in different periods of its history. Thank you very much for your attention.